Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with writers in the studios of North State Public Radio. Now here's your host, Nancy Wiegman.
My first guest is author of more than 90 nonfiction and fiction books for children, teachers, and families. TV weatherman Mike Graff speaks at schools and conferences all over the United States, and he has a new book, Natural Laboratories, Scientists in National Parks. Mike Graff, welcome.
Hi. Thanks for having me again, Nancy.
Now, I mentioned that you're a TV weatherman, but people may not see you very often. Maybe on the weekends, I think, aren't you, on Channel 12?
Yeah, recently I was on Channel 12 for most of the last year when I was in town. And it was more of a fill-in position, not a regular position. They were kind of in an interim situation, and I filled the gap over there.
Well, because you travel a lot for your, sorry to call it your work, but it hardly seems like work, Mike.
Well, there are days it is and days it isn't. It's actually, it's a labor of love. But I go to schools all over. About 6 weeks of my year, I'm in Las Vegas. Not 6 weeks in a row, but three different two-week periods of time. And I do presentations and workshops in schools all over the country. Assemblies, kind of theatrical performances, things like that.
Well, you were a teacher for a while yourself. And in fact, that's kind of how you got started, isn't it? And your interest in weather.
I was a teacher for 10 years in San Luis Obispo. I taught fourth and fifth grade, and I had a weather station put on my campus there, and I became a spotter station for the San Luis Obispo TV station. And one day, the meteorologist and I were friends, so I brought my class in to go on the green wall. They all got to do a demo weather forecast, and the meteorologist put me on air just to see how I would do, just for fun, and they ended up giving me a job. So
I say, this guy's pretty good.
Good enough, anyway.
Well, now, I think people know what a green wall is, but you might explain that when you're forecasting the weather, you're not what you see is not what we see.
Yeah, well, we have a green wall right behind me in the studio, but for me to see where the maps are, to see where I'm pointing, I've got, well, I memorize it and I practice ahead of time, but I can look into the camera and I can see the map behind me, and there's monitors on each side of me also. So if I turn right or left, I will see where I'm pointing to. And after you do that a few times, it's a little bit like riding a bike. You kind of know where everything is.
My guest is Mike Graff, and he is a TV weatherman when he's in town in Chico. And otherwise, you wear a lot of hats. You got started writing about national parks, and what got you interested in national parks?
My family and I, when I was my daughter's age, my daughter's 10 turning 11, we would do these 2-3 week summer vacations. Now, my dad and mom were always into Lake Tahoe, so we always ended it in Lake Tahoe. But before we got to Lake Tahoe, it was Yosemite, Sequoia, Lassen, Crater Lake, Yellowstone, Grand Teton. So we would go on road trips to national parks. When I was a teacher, one of my first books that I wrote was National Parks Projects. It's a teacher's guide to bring the national parks into the classroom. And I was traveling to parks all the time in my 20s and 30s also. And at that point in time, a publisher found me and said, would you be interested in doing a series of books on national parks? But we don't quite have the idea how it's going to go yet. So come meet with our team and let's brainstorm together. And that's how it got started.
So your brainstorming group came up with this idea to say, well, let's write fiction, have this family, but now should the child be a boy or a girl? So I'm imagining what took place, and then you said, well, let's have one of each.
It was a big group of people and marketing teams and production people, and at one point we were going to have a family of 6 children. And they were going to be foster children with different ethnicities. And that would really fit well within the parks because there's so much diversity going on in park history. But eventually we narrowed it down to let's have a boy and girl and let's have them twins so we can really focus on a certain age. And the age group we kind of centered on was 8 to 12. So Morgan and James Parker are the two boys, the twins, fraternal twins, and they're 9 turning 10. And they've been 9 turning 10 for 13 books now.
Well, you know what I enjoy about the fact that you have a boy and a girl is that you get the perspective, because even though we try to treat boys and girls the same, they really aren't, I don't think. So we get to see, oh, here's how what the little girl found interesting about the park, and here's what the young boy found interesting about the park.
They definitely have different interests, and they each write in a journal, a fictional journal, but this is what I saw and did today, this is what I'm thinking. Originally, with this team of people, there was a female author who was going to do the girl's perspective, I was going to do the boy's perspective, but for various reasons, it all went over to me. So I cover both.
So you wrote, how many of these books did you write about the Parker twins?
There's 13 of them now.
13.
The last one that came out just before the book we're looking at here, The Scientist's Natural Laboratory, was in Sequoia Kings Canyon also. That's about a year and a half ago. And so there's 13. There is discussion about another, or emails this morning. Shouldn't talk too much about it. I'll jinx it.
So when you, your family of you, your wife and your daughter, go to a national park, say, it's really, you're doing research. So you're probably watching how your daughter reacts to these situations. Say, oh, I'll put that in the book.
When I'm on assignment, I carry around a tape recorder. And so when I come back, it's 2 weeks in the park. And yeah, my daughter has come to some of these books that we've written about, Grand Teton, Acadia, and Sequoia. But now it becomes this little, you know, tug of war. Can I have the tape recorder now? I got an idea. Can I have the tape recorder now? And so we all write, or we all speak in it. And I've got about 20 to 30 hours of tape when I come home. And it's ideas or dialogue or scenes or descriptions of scenery or events that have happened. And eventually I'll listen to all of that and kind of section it out chapter by chapter, make an order that would make sense. Because the premise is it's a family going to this place for vacation. So what order of scenes would make sense for an average person or family going on vacation in that park? And then what things are going to happen in each of these areas of the park? So it becomes a chapter order, and I use different parts of the taping, and then I start making it into fiction or realistic fiction.
And along the way, though, we learn a lot of interesting facts. So it is fiction, the story itself, that you weave together these facts that capture our attention.
Well, one of the publishers is Far Country Press right now, and they're an outdoor publisher. They do hiking guides and other guides. Another publisher, it's kind of moved around, is Falcon Guides, and they're big on hiking and outdoor guides. So we look at these books as fiction and a story, but also guidebooks. And the characters, particularly the twins, will journal, you know, what's my favorite scene? Where should you go? What did I like the best? And then we put in little sidebars. If there's a grizzly bear scene, we'll put in sidebars about grizzly bear behavior. Or if there's some geology going on and geyser stuff going on in Yellowstone, we'll put in a sidebar about that. So it's fiction, nonfiction combined.
Well, I would imagine, being an adult myself, that the family member, the adults, the mom and dad that are reading these books, are fascinated also by these things that they learn. I didn't know that. Often when I read your book and I read something, some fact, you mentioned the grizzly bears, I didn't know that.
And that's the whole thing. And there's a lot of families who, yeah, I mean, you know, if we look at a marketing opportunity, families who go to national parks, of which there are a lot, and we're in the middle of finishing our plans for this summer to a few parks. And it is for them. It's for them. This is where we could go. This is what this fictitious family did, or this is where we went last summer. Now we can learn more about it. Speaking of grizzly bears, one of the little facts about grizzlies, you know, they're extinct in California, but they're in parts of Washington, Idaho, Wyoming, and Montana. The last surviving grizzly bear, in my understanding, and this is based on an interview when I did the Sequoia book, was in the giant Sequoia forest where the giant trees are in part of the park. That was in the 1920s, the last California surviving grizzly.
My guest is Mike Graff, and he is an expert in the national parks. He writes nonfiction and fiction books for children, for families, for teachers about these parks. You know, you're speaking of the grizzly bear, and I saw a report on PBS that just was heartbreaking. This photographer was photographing grizzlies, and there was a mother bear, didn't have a name, but she had a number. And because she was so well known, she was a target for hunters who wanted to have the, not the privilege, but who wanted to be the one to shoot that bear. Oh, gosh. This is why the work you're doing, Mike, is so important, I think, to have children learn that this is, nature is so precious.
Yeah, and how we look at nature is we don't all look at it the same way. I did want to mention the number thing. There is a grizzly that lives in Grand Teton. Bear 399 is her name.
That's her.
Oh, goodness. Now I'm going to get that response, too.
Oh,
she's a very famous bear. The bears in Yellowstone and Grand Teton are considered within the same ecosystem. the grizzlies, you know, that they can range in that area. So what the rangers do there to protect and study them is they will capture them and tag them, and they give them a number, and the number becomes their name. So that was the order they were tagged. 399 has a long history. She's been seen over the years. I actually covered her in the Grand Teton book. She's in that story. And she's near Rhodes. She's had a couple of litters. A few years ago, one of her cubs, while she was still with three cubs, accidentally switched moms during what they presume was a bear attack. A male grizzly came after her cubs, and it was in the evening or nighttime, and she ran to a different grizzly in the area, 610. Turns out 610 is 399's daughter, who had grown up and now is having a litter of her own. 399 is having her second litter. So a male apparently came in, and one of 399's cubs ran to 610 to get away and took off with 610. And the rangers there in Grand Teton monitored this, and turns out 399's cub stayed with 610 the rest of its youth until it could live on its own. So 610 adopted 399's cub. And that's a famous story in Grand Teton. It's pretty unusual that there's a bear adoption in the wild. But she's a famous bear because she's often spotted. And my wife and daughter spotted her when we were on research.
So you've actually seen her.
Got a picture of her in our Grand Teton book.
Well, one thing, too, I think the more we know about bears, the less likely we would be to take a life, because they're such intelligent creatures, so intelligent.
They are. You know, there are controversies. I'm in complete agreement with you, and they are protected within the park boundaries, but there are no fences at those boundaries. So when they go outside of the park, and you think of a place like Wyoming, and they go onto ranch lands, and if there's cattle there and there's controversy about cattle kills, you know, the ranchers will get protective, and there becomes the issue. Or hunters as well.
My guest is TV weatherman Mike Graff, who writes books for children, teachers, and families about the national parks. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wiegman. I'm Nancy Wiegman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, Mike Graff, who writes books for children, but adults can learn from them too. He writes about the national parks, and his latest book is Natural Laboratories, Scientist in National Parks. Now, we've mentioned your fictional books that have facts in them, but your most recent book now, this is called Natural Laboratories, Scientists in National Parks. So you have written a book that is all fact. And how did you get involved with this project?
You know, as a published author, sometimes publishers will go out on recruit missions. You know, we're doing this particular book that takes place in Sequoia Kings Canyon is a part of a series. I mean, you can see on the back, there's six in the series. And so they came up with this idea of let's cover what scientists do in national parks. They came up with that idea in-house, and then they went out looking for authors who might be good fits for these books. So it was last summer, my family and I were in Redwood National Park at the time, and I got an email from this publisher, and they're an educational publisher, and we pulled over an internet cafe where we had Wi-Fi and started responding to their query, and I said, absolutely, yes, I just finished a fiction book on Sequoia. I have good contacts there, and so now it's one of these six books out.
Well, it makes sense that this would be an educational publisher because the very beginning, the first page in your book, not page one, but the beginning page, is you have activities and the teachers or the parents can just look at this and say, oh, that's a good idea. For example, you have activities for before the reading, during the reading, and after. So, for example, you have vocabulary, like carbonic acid. And I'm wondering, parents read that, ooh, carbonic acid, I don't know what that is. I've heard of it. But so you have vocabulary. And you suggest that they start by looking at the cover of the book and saying, well, what will this book be about? So they look at the cover of your book, and what do they see?
Well, they see sequoias, which are the largest trees, actually the largest living things on Earth. In fact, California has the two largest trees, which turns out to be the two largest living things on Earth. We have such amazing diversity in our ecosystems. So we've got the giant sequoias, which are in 75 groves in the central and southern Sierra Nevada. And the most prolific of those groves are in Sequoia and Kings Canyon National Park. And then we got the giant redwoods, which are on the coast between Santa Cruz and the southern Oregon coast. Now, redwoods grow taller. They grow over 300 feet. But sequoias, they top out under 300 feet, but they're so bulky at their base. There's much more wood on a sequoia than a redwood. I did want to mention carbonic acid, though. people look at Sequoia and Kings Canyon. You've got the high peaks and the sequoia forests and the meadows, but there's over 275 caves in those two parks. The main cave that everybody knows about if you go is Crystal Cave. It's the only one that's commercially open to the public where they do tours. And carbonic acid is a combination of rainwater combining with decaying plants and animals at the soil surface that trickles into the marble that's beneath the ground there, and it's corrosive. It dissolves the passages into caves, and so it's a big part of the caves there.
Well, you mentioned the redwoods, and something I didn't know until I read your book, I think of the California redwoods, but there's another redwood that I'd never heard of, the Dawn Redwood, because it's in isolated parts of China.
Yeah, and I don't know its preservation status or how extensive it is, but I do know it is part of the genetic family. Interesting side note about that, we mentioned Yellowstone. There is, and there are, and I know Yellowstone's one of the places, fossils, petrified wood of sequoias in other places. And Yellowstone is one of them. But right now, there's only 75 groves left in California. So as the climate has changed, as continents have shifted, that's the only region right now where they can exist today. But they've existed in other places in the past.
Well, we were mentioning the cover, and you do have a human being sitting on, it looks like the trunk of a sawed down tree, and we get to see, gosh, he looks so small on this huge tree.
It was a big deal. You know, in the 1800s, people saw these trees. You know, if you think about, the map, it's east of Fresno, Visalia. That's their main region. So 60 miles up in the mountains are these massive trees. And the people who first saw them, they were blown away. And then they tried to take remnants or sections of them and let's bring them down and ship them places to prove that these trees exist. And some people were like, this is a hoax. This isn't true.
They call it, in your book, you say the California hoax.
The hoax. And you can see that on signage in the park. But the other thing was these trees have so much wood on them. If you take a single tree, it's like, well, we can make cabins and homes and furniture and tracks. So it became a big deal to cut the trees. One of the problems with that, though, is it could take a long time to cut the trees. And then when they fall, they brittle. They shatter and fall apart. So a lot of the wood was lost. But they have an extensive history department that I was able to interview there. And one of the things they would do, the loggers, is they would make a bed. They would put debris and branches and leaves and all that in the path where the tree was going to fall to reduce the breaking of the tree when it did fall. But in the midst of all that, a couple of people, Walter Fry and a couple others, they found that we really shouldn't cut all these trees down. We will not get to see them in the future. So a national park movement was started in the late 1800s, as the logging movement was going on. And that ended the cutting of the trees.
You know what? Speaking of this guy who turned advocate, I thought of the little boy who aims at a bird with his slingshot. He kills the bird and after realizes, what have I done? I've taken a life. And here was this guy who cuts down this, what did it take him 5 days to saw it down? And when he counted the rings, he thought, oh my gosh, I've killed this living thing that was over 3,000 years old. And when it dawned on him what he'd done, he eventually became a park ranger.
Yeah. Yeah, you can count the rings, and the rings are a year of growth. And some of the rings we now know, and dendrochronology is the study of that. You can see where fire scars were. You can see years of abundant growth with lots of rain and snow. You can see periods of drought where there was little growth. But either way, they're going to get a new ring every year. So he cuts down a tree, he and others, takes him 5 days, counts 3,000 years, and then decides we're going to stop this. He was the third person on the list to sign
The petition.
To make it a national park.
Yeah, I thought that was great.
Yeah.
Another thing, too, besides counting the rings, just the numbers, 1, 2, 3, that they can also see, you mentioned drought, so they can see what the level of stress was that that tree went through in any particular year.
Correct. And they're still doing that now. And so there's a lot of science going on in the park. One of the things they do now is they'll have someone scale the tree and take this increment bore, this ring reading about 30 feet.
So in other
off
words,
the
they don't bore down at the base.
Correct.
But they go up, 33 feet?
Approximately that.
And bore into the tree with this instrument to find out.
If you do that at the base and interviewing the scientists there, that could stress the tree. It also could tap out the water. So they do it above to not stress the tree. It's all about protecting those.
Yeah.
And they're beautiful. Hiking in a sequoia forest, it's unbelievable. And there's a number of them in both parks that are really easy to get to. The two that are like you park your car and walk 10 minutes is Grant Grove in Kings Canyon National Park and the Giant Forest in Sequoia National Park, which has over 2,000 of the big trees and a lot of babies. But the biggest one in all that is the General Sherman tree, which is a 10-minute walk from where you park. And it's the largest sequoia, largest living thing on Earth. Hundreds of people a day, maybe thousands, will walk by it.
It's hard to imagine any living thing being that old and still surviving.
They're not the oldest living things, though. Bristlecone pine. Which is also a western tree. It's in parts of California, Nevada, Utah. It may be some in Arizona and Colorado also. The White Mountains of California, which are on the east side of the Sierra Nevada, some of the trees in bristlecone pine forests will be up to 5,000 years old or older.
Well, when we look at the age of these trees and we learn more and more about them, I think we're also learning, I got this from your book, that the climate is changing. I mean, there are people who deny that, but it looks like the trees are evidence of climate change. Is that not true?
The climate is changing, and one of the ways to show that with the trees, and not all positive, the elevation of trees, not particularly with sequoia trees, is rising. You know, as the climate warms, some of the trees will go higher in their elevation to where their growth is. What could be more of an effect with sequoia trees, you know, it's high mountain area, and the Sequoia Range is between 4,000 and 8,000 feet. That's pretty much where all the groves are. There may be an isolated grove or tree or two below or above that. And that's where they get the winter snows, an abundant snow, and then you get the spring melting, and then you have pretty much warm, dry summers with occasional thundershowers. But now, and we had a great winter in California. We had some of the best snow we've seen in 200% of normal in some areas, including Sequoia Forest. So I feel like it's a reprieve. We get a couple years off of this perennial drought. But with the climate changing, they're getting more rain than snow compared to history. And they're also getting periods of drought. And one of the things that's happening with periods of drought is the bark beetle.
Yes. When I read about that, I thought, gosh darn, I didn't realize that the bark beetle was a threat, and he thrives in the drought.
Thrives in the drought and thrives also with climate change. My understanding, bark beetle are doing havoc to trees all over the western United States. In fact, when I went there for this recent book, and as you're driving up from Fresno, and then you get up to 5,000-6,000 feet, and you're starting to see some of the sequoia forests, there's a lot of forest death going on, not just with sequoia trees. And some of that's drought, and some of that's bark beetle, and they kind of work together. In the past, bark beetles would always be there, but winter freezes would kill off a percentage of them when the temperatures got cold enough, and it had to be significantly cold enough, and so some of them would die off. But now, we're not getting those periods of cold enough to kill off and balance that out. So the bark beetle are spreading and the trees are dying. One of the neat things they're doing in Sequoia Kings Canyon, and they can only do it in select areas, but they're doing it in other places too, Grand Teton, is there's pheromone patches.
Yes, I was surprised when I read that in your book. I thought, oh, they're using pheromones to combat the beetle problem.
They do. It puts out a scent. I don't know, you know, I'm not privy to the science of all this, but I know they will go to select groves, and those groves are not necessarily Sequoia, but trees in general, where there's high visitor visitation, where they don't want to see all these trees dead, and they'll put in, it's like a little applicator, and they'll squirt it in there, and that sends a message to the bark beetles, the tree's already taken, so you got to go somewhere else. And it is working, you know, but you can't do that everywhere. You can't do the forest everywhere. It's expensive, it's hard to identify, and we don't know if it's going to have extensive benefits, but it is helping in select areas of the park and in other parks.
My guest is Mike Graff, and his most recent book is a book of nonfiction for, it's a children's book. It's a part of a series, Natural Laboratories, Scientists in the National Parks. And one thing you mentioned, using a pheromone, using a natural product to combat the beetle, and something else that is natural that in the past we didn't think was helpful. So we thought, gosh, a fire, we got to put the fire out. And we've learned since, no, you don't put the fires out. You actually start some fires.
Well, you know, there's always been natural fires, and they can prove that through the rings. You can see where there are fire scars. So up until the 1960s, with buildings and tourism and cars and lodges, it seemed like the right idea. You know, if there's a fire, we're going to put it out. And of course, the philosophy still is now, we're going to protect visitors and we're going to protect structures. However, as far as new growth of sequoias, they need fires. And that's probably true with other plants too. So what happens, a sequoia tree will drop thousands of cones, and each cone has thousands of seeds, and fires open up the cones. So without a fire, the cones don't open up, the seeds don't fall out. But fires will also clear out an area of land. So if they're all competing for sunlight and they're competing for water. So if you burn out an area, or if a burn is natural, then that area is primed for growth, and the fires put nitrogen in the soil, so they fertilize it. So now what they're doing is, if there's a lightning cause or natural burn and it's not harmful or threatening any structures, they will let it burn. And if there's areas of sequoias where they're not getting burns, they will prescribe burns. And if you go to these sequoia forests now, you will see hundreds, probably thousands of baby sequoias. And up until the 1960s, when fire policy was put them out, they weren't getting that regeneration. So it's really a big deal that we've got the next generation of sequoias growing now because we learned about fire.
Well, and that's why I think it's so great, Mike, that you aim this information at young people, because they're the generation that's going to be making the decisions as to what to do and how to preserve this natural resource.
Yeah, it's a big deal. You got to passing that torch, and so many families go. There's a lot of things that are being studied there, but the air pollution is an issue. But the area has, some have described it, unfortunately, some of the worst air pollution in the country. And if you go down to Fresno to Bakersfield area in the summer, you can see that trapped, stagnant air. And there's various reasons for it, the farming and the highways and the trucks. But it's also a weather pattern. It's trapped down there. You know, the wind will blow it from the Bay Area down against the Sierra and Tehachapi Mountains, and it circulates. So what's that doing to the sequoias? And the scientists are working on it. And I got to, you know, interview several of the scientists there. And they're finding that the giant trees, the mature sequoias, are pretty resistant to it, even though where the pollution is coming right into the forest. But the baby trees are not. You know, the baby sequoias are getting a corrosive agent on their needles, and they call it chorionic metal, and it's actually discoloring them and making them vulnerable to stress, so they don't know how well they're going to do because of the pollution.
So the young trees are vulnerable to this pollution that the older trees are not.
That's what they found so far, yeah.
Golly. Well, when adults read your book, have you gotten feedback about what surprises them? Because I mentioned some of the things that, I didn't know that, Mike.
there's always feedback. I can't recall specific feedback right now about this book. I can tell you there were surprises, you know, for me when I read it. One of them was the meadows there. And I know I put in a section about that. The meadows are iconic. I have early childhood memories of going to Crescent Meadow and Long Meadow. These are vivid green meadows right in the heart of the giant trees. And there's trails by them, and they're unbelievable. But in the past, they used to cattle graze those meadows. And so meadows need precipitation to stay green, and they also need groundwater. But because they put cattle in there in the past, they would do these ditches and gullies to divert water and make it a place for cattle. And now they're going in there, and they're taking some of those ditches and gullies out to try to get the groundwater and the natural water flow back and restore those meadows. One other thing about the meadows there, and my wife and daughter and I got to experience this. I mean, the giant forest has a number of meadows, and there's 40 miles of trails that weave through all the sequoias, trees and meadows there. The bears are everywhere. We saw on one 6-7 mile hike, and you can kind of interlocking trails, 7 bears on one trail, and every one of them was in the meadows. Now, that's not always something you want to see up close. There's no grizzlies, but we saw a mother and a cub, a lot of cubs. It's like, oh, there's a bear, there's a bear. Then people are coming the other way. There's going to be a bear over there. It was unbelievable. And so they're thriving in the park. Just remember, you call out and give them space and back away, but there's a lot of bear in Sequoia Kings Canyon. And they were there when I was a child, too. They've changed some of the policies. Back then, they would get into the garbage and all that, which they take away now. They're bear-resistant garbage now.
Well, you mentioned when you, in your stories, you have the two children in the fictional stories, write, keep a journal. And you suggest that just as students are reading this book, or a child in the family, that they jot down things, write as well as read. So they're reading this information in your book. But you also suggest that they write down their impressions. And this is on this first page of your book, where you make suggestions while they're reading, and that's what you call the writing component. So they're reading what you've written, and then they write down, you say, while you're reading, write in your reading journal any questions you have or anything you don't understand. And then after they read it, you want them to think about how the sequoia trees have been protected. So they summarize what they learned from your book about how we're protecting these wonderful trees that you write about. And then you ask, why did some people want to cut down sequoias? You had the example of the guy that cut one down and then realized, oh, this is not what we should be doing. Yeah.
Well, I mean, part of the educational components is this is a Rourke Publishing is an educational publisher. So our market is school libraries and, you know, homeschool markets, so that they've got things ready to use and make it a learning experience beyond just the reading. You know, the cutting down, there were the two reasons. It was for the wood, and it was to show the world, look at these trees. Some people didn't believe it right away. In some cases, they would just take the trunk or the bark from the trunk, called skinning a tree. John Muir was an advocate against skinning the tree. It was like, why would you do that to a living thing? But it was a lot easier to haul the skin rather than the whole thing. And they'd ship it back east and put it on display and say, look what's going on in California. And others would say, that's not real.
Well, John Muir is certainly one of the heroes here in California and elsewhere. And you are too, Mike, a hero for those people who appreciate nature and want our young people to learn about nature. And this is such a nice way to do that. So thank you so much for writing this series and this recent book in particular. Let me mention the name of it again, Sequoia and Kings Canyon. And this is part of a series, Natural Laboratories, Scientists in National Parks.
I just say Sequoia and Kings Canyon are amazing places to visit, spring and summer. And the sequoia groves are so easy to get to, and there's nothing like walking in one of those groves. And it's a lot cooler up there in the summer, too.
Oh, thank you for that, Mike. My guest has been TV weatherman Mike Graff. He's also a writer, and his most recent book, Sequoia and Kings Canyon, part of the Natural Laboratory series, Scientist in National Parks. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. When I come back, I'll be talking to Terry Lewillier, who writes books also for children about nature. Thank you. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. My next guest observed eagles, Liberty and Patriot, and in 2012, I asked her to tell us the story of these two eagles. Welcome, Terry Lou Willier.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Joanne Brady is an instructional aide. She enjoys being outdoors and writing children's stories. Joanne is the mother of the illustrator of the Unstoppable Eagles. Her daughter, Sarah Brady, is a recent graduate of UC Berkeley with a degree in architecture. Welcome, Joanne Brady.
Thanks for having us.
You know, the title of your book is The Unstoppable Eagles. And why would anybody want to stop a pair of eagles? What were they doing that they needed stopping?
That's a great question, Nancy. They were nesting right next to a very large bridge reconstruction project, and that was not going to be a good spot for them.
I'm just wondering, who thinks it's not going to be a good spot? I mean, the eagles must have thought it was a good spot.
Exactly. The eagles had picked the spot out prior to the environmental plan went into place. And what the concern that the Caltrans and some and Fish and Game and these other agencies was that the eagles might be disturbed by the noise and the bright lights, because there was going to be lights 24 hours.
So when they built the nest, that was before construction started.
Exactly.
So the eagles didn't know what was in store.
Exactly. Yes.
And
right.
Where is this bridge?
This is the Highway 44 bridge that goes right through the middle of Redding, California. Mm-hmm. Yeah, right in the middle of town.
So they were used to the traffic, the noise from the traffic, and they had lived there for a while before the construction started. So they were used to a little bit of noise.
So then what did Caltrans decide to do about it?
Well, Caltrans met with the Department of Fish and Game, and they brought in some – had a community meeting with some Sierra Club members, some Audubon people, and they talked over what might be the best option for them to deter the eagles from nesting there.
So far the eagles have just started building it. Did they complete the nest?
The eagles had completed the nest, yes, at
but
this time.
But no eggs had been laid.
Right, okay. Right. Okay. And they were actively working on the nest. These eagles are – a little different. They come back in October and start working on their nests, even though they don't lay eggs till February. Mm-hmm. But they come back to Redding. I'm not sure how far they actually go from Redding, but they come back to the area, start working on the nest, and then Caltrans decides we've got to stop them from nesting here, because if they do decide to abandon their nest or, you know, their eggs or eaglets, then we've got a problem. So they decided the best option was to put a large cone made to specs to fit over an eagle's nest on top of their nest.
Now, who comes up with an idea like this?
Our publisher had found out that it is a used method for blocking nests, and I had never heard of it happening before and was quite shocked when I drove by and saw it myself. And I didn't understand what was happening and who would do that and why they would do that. So I started
because
making quite
like
a few
a
phone calls.
It seems like a cruel thing to do.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah, and it didn't seem like the right thing to do, because there are laws protecting bald eagles. And so I was very concerned and made quite a few phone calls and found out that it was Caltrans and that they obviously had good intentions. They were afraid of disturbing the eagles. But the eagles didn't get that message, and the eagles decided to stay. And they perched themselves right above the nest and sat there and refused to leave. Yeah, with the cone on the nest, they would still sit there. And they were just stayed with the nest. And at one point, the eagles, after I don't remember how much time had gone by, but they decided to start building a new nest. And this was one tree over from where this nest was at. And they started bringing in some sticks and building a new nest. And Caltrans hired a tree climber to go up and take those sticks down.
And now, meanwhile, you're watching this. At what point did you start watching the eagles?
Oh, gosh. I'd been watching the eagles since they came to this area, because I actually have been hiking in this area for about 18 years.
But so in about the time of year, it was October.
It was October.
And you started watching.
They had returned in October, and we had been watching them start bringing in sticks and working on the nest.
And then, Joanne, were you also, did you start watching that same time, or did you come in later?
Well, Terry and I, we have a lot of contact with each other, so she always lets me know. And once in a while, I'll join her for a walk. So I was aware that the nest was there, too, because Terry had told me about it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, once you know it's there, you always look for it. When you drive, you look for the eagles. And so she, you know, Terry keeps me pretty updated.
So the eagles have built one nest, right. And the accepted method of stopping eagles from nesting where you don't want them to nest is to put a big cone over the nest.
Right.
So the eagles say, well, all right, but we like the neighborhood, so we're going to build one anyway. And so then they send a person up there to dismantle their nest. I mean, if you were watching this, did you actually see the guy climb up there to do that? Or?
There actually are photographs of it. A Record Searchlight photographer took a picture of that, and that was in the paper. I contacted a Record Searchlight reporter, Dylan Darling, who covered the story from the beginning. And so there were stories, front page articles of this story going on for quite some time, and they still are in the paper quite a bit. A wildlife photographer also got a picture of the eagles attacking the cone at one point, too, that was also put in the paper. But once we saw pictures of them taking down that new nest, and I really started making a lot more phone calls and going, there's no way this could be happening, and really stirred things up and eventually got a group together. I just put a little thing after Redding.com and said, if there's anyone else that's upset about this and wants to meet me at Angelo's Pizza. And I didn't know who was going to show up. And about 8 people showed up from all different walks of life, and they were as upset as I was about what was going on. And so we contacted Caltrans and told them, you know, asked them if they would mind sitting down and discussing this and maybe some other options. And what we came up with was that we had heard about the use of eagle cams. This had been a practice that people had been following eagles through the use of eagle cams. So we thought, well, why not replace that cone with an eagle cam? And if you're concerned about them abandoning their eggs or eaglets, then you can go up and, you know, rescue them or do something. So obviously the eagles are not leaving, because even once they took down the sticks of their new nest, they still stayed in that area. And they stayed in the area for 32 days before the cone finally, after we talked to Caltrans, they agreed to meet with us, which was wonderful. And we sat down at a big long table with a lot of people and had a discussion. We really didn't even have to say anything. By that point, they realized it was probably the right thing to do, was to take that cone down. And they'd been getting a lot of probably not so good PR about it being in the paper so often. And I think some people had contacted Barbara Boxer and Feinstein because it was getting that big. And some Native Americans were involved in it, and I came to find out that this is actually a sacred site at Turtle Bay. So once they got involved, things moved pretty rapidly, and before we even asked them to replace the cone with a camera, they announced that they were going to be taking the cone down tomorrow. So
the eagles get back their original nest then.
They did, right.
And then meanwhile, Joanne, your sister is the one who really is the birder in the family, but you like to write children's stories. At what point did you say, this could be a great children's book?
Well, it was a great story, and it was actually Terry's idea. You know, she was, you know, because she'd been so much a part of the story, and she came to me and asked me if I would want to be a part of it. And at first I thought, you know, it's your story, Terry. You've been close to it. But then it has been something I've always wanted to do, so write a children's story. So I thought, well, it'd be kind of neat to go through the process. And it has been quite a journey. It's been pretty.
And meanwhile, your daughter, who studied architecture, mm-hmm. becomes the illustrator of this children's book.
Yeah, Terry had asked her. She actually asked her before she asked me, because she just has always loved to draw. I mean, since she was 4 years old, she would draw for hours, and we knew that she had the skill. She had actually made something for Terry. It's a game. It's called Cornhole, and she had painted. She just got all her paints from the garage and mixed paints together, and she painted some eagles on the board, because Terry is such an eagle lover. And we knew that she had the skills to do it. So,
just might remind listeners that I'm talking to the authors of The Unstoppable Eagles, Terry Lou Willier and Joanne Brady. And the story is illustrated by Joanne's daughter, Sarah Brady. So this is a family project that you're working on. And
yes.
Before it becomes a book project, it's a project to help out these eagles who are being disturbed. I mean, nobody has ill will against the eagles, but they just, you don't think they're going about it in the right way.
Exactly, yeah.
So this eagle cam, we're calling it, was installed so that people could watch the eagles.
Right, right.
And in the foreword of your book, there's a bald eagle biologist named David Hancock that writes the foreword, and he says that during the first month that camcorder was there, 55 million viewers were watching those eagles.
Yeah, and I think he might be referring to some eagles, some of the very first eagle cams that he had put up. Hancock Wildlife has a lot of different eagle cams, but I think he's referring to that. But we did get a lot of views on the Turtle Bay eagles and people viewing from all over the world, which was so neat. That really, they'd heard a little bit about this story maybe through the newspaper articles, and so they started following them. Now, the eagle cam didn't go up until the following season, mm-hmm. the following nesting season, due to they didn't want to disturb the eagles anymore at that point. So they had a biologist on the ground monitor them for the rest of that season. Mm-hmm. And they did fine. They went on to raise two chicks all the way to fledging. They successfully fledged, which is great. And then, you know, they all took off and then went their ways for the summer and came back in October. And that's when they had installed the Eagle Cam and we got to watch on
well,
that.
Now, you mentioned, and you have a section in the back of your book called Critter Chit Chatter.
Yes, right. Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned in there that some bald eagles do migrate.
Exactly. A lot of bald eagles. And matter of fact, Tule Lake is one of the largest populations of eagles in this area where they come in winter there. But they don't believe that Patriot Liberty, like I said, I usually see them. I take a lot of photographs of them and I see them in this area till July, middle of July. And then I don't see them again until October. But that's not a real long period of time. So we really don't think they migrate. Mm-hmm. But and they have a great food supply. We also follow a couple other eagle's nests and they're all along the Sacramento River. So that's a great source of food for them there.
Well, now you just mentioned, you said two names that haven't come up before. You said Liberty and Patriot.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And you did not originate the names yourself, yep. either of you,
no,
correct?
No. Mm-hmm.
So how did you go about assigning names to these eagles?
Okay. Well, what happened was once the community got so involved with these eagles, following them through the newspaper and this whole great story that happened, they decided to let the people vote. And the Record Searchlight, and I think Channel 7 was involved, put out a vote and had people send in suggestions. Some of them were quite humorous, like Conehead and things like that, you know, just little jokes about the cone. And then they ended up voting and Patriot and Liberty won. And they've also named some of the offspring, the eaglets. And one year they let school children name them, which was really special for me being a teacher. I really like that. And
so this became a community project of assigning names to these eagles. Mm-hmm. And I think people guess maybe Lady Liberty and Patriot was the male.
Yeah, you're right.
But then your community grew to include the whole world. That must have been thrilling for
mm-hmm.
you.
Yeah. Yeah. And people, when we're out on the trail right now, Terry is usually out there with a spotting scope and she lets people look through it. And they all know about Patriot and Liberty. A lot of people seem to know the story. Of course, it was on the front page of the newspaper often when this was going on. And they still keep it updated. They always let everybody know what's going on. Usually find out from Terry.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, I mentioned that it is a children's story. It's a story of these eagles. But it also, and here comes your background as teachers, is that you want students to not only know the story about the eagles, but to learn something about mm-hmm. eagles. And I mentioned this page that you have of facts about mm-hmm. the bald eagles. And I thought a lot of it was very interesting. For example, that depending on where a bald eagle lives, it tends to be smaller in the southern part, like an eagle in Florida might weigh 6 pounds and have a 6-foot wingspan,
right.
whereas an eagle in Alaska would be 16 pounds
right.
and an 8-foot wingspan.
Right.
And I'm guessing that's because the extra body mass helps them stay warm in these cold climates.
Yeah, probably so. And the food supply, I think, is better mm-hmm. up north than mm-hmm. it would be in the south. And that's been the great thing, Nancy, for me, that since I started following these eagles and since all of this happened, I have learned so much myself about eagles through Hancock Wildlife, who, you know, David Hancock wrote the foreword. The people have been so generous and with sharing information with me. And so I've learned a lot. So this book was an opportunity for me to share what I've learned about eagles and just that great story that happened too.
Well, I think you can't help it. If you go out in nature and you watch this bird, whether it's eagles or whatever kind of bird it is, you begin to wonder about this, the life mm-hmm. of a bird like that. And, well, why does that bird? Because birds vary so much. And you think, well, why does a bald eagle not have feathers on his legs?
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And what did you find out?
Yeah, exactly. And they don't. Well, I think that's part of, you know, keeping them clean. With the feathers not on the legs, and just they go in the water or the edges of the water, you know, so mm-hmm. it helps them with the cleaning and stuff. But following the pair with bald eagles, they mate for life. So the relationship, for me personally, I enjoy watching the relationship between the male and the female and the calling that they do to each other and the bond that's there. They've been together. They're on their sixth nesting season this year. So they've been together, and I think they were together a year before that. So 7 years together, and mm-hmm. they're very good parents. So it's wonderful to watch the dedication they have.
I think that's part of the reason it captures people's imagination, because they are a pair and you know that they mate for life.
Right.
And that things like, this is a family. We don't want to disturb a family.
Exactly.
These two eagles are mates and they're going to raise a family here. We don't want to interfere mm-hmm. with their family, but we do want to watch.
Yeah, exactly. We do. And last spring, Nancy, it was really interesting. We had a really wild spring. I'm sure you guys probably did here in Chico as well. We had a lot of hail, a lot of storm, really windy storms. farms, and it was the week that the eaglets were hatching out that this was happening. And I have this one image in my mind that I'll never forget, and this is, shows you the dedication of the of these two adult birds, was that one of the eaglets hatched out on Tuesday, and the second eaglet hatched out on Friday, and a really bad storm came in all week long, but on Friday was getting very bad. And I looked on the eagle cam Friday afternoon, and the male eagle was on top of the two chicks, and the female eagle was on top of him.
So and they're both protecting
they were,
their
you know,
young.
She was all splayed
spread,
out, just protecting him. And he was, and that was the only way those two chicks survived, and they survived through that. A lot of people, actually some of the people from Hancock Wildlife had privately emailed me and said, I think we might lose the first chick because it hadn't been fed for the first couple days because they had to protect it and shelter it. They weren't able to get food for it. And but they do have a bit of a like a yolk sac type of thing, like a salmon has. They have some food with them for the first about a day and a half. But it had been about 2 days, and it wasn't eating. And it wasn't moving much. So they're like, they just wanted to let me know that you may have to let your students know this one might not make it. But sure enough, it made it. And every one of their eaglets has made it to fledging. So that's pretty impressive for eagles.
So I think that's another example. You were saying, I think in your book somewhere, that the eagles knew what they were doing. We human beings didn't think they knew what they were doing, but they survived all the commotion. It didn't bother them. They raised their young. So they knew what they were doing when they were selecting the nesting site. And then they know what they're doing. If a storm comes, they know how to protect their eaglets.
They did. They did. Yes. They realized all along, and that was kind of the message of the story. Yes.
Well, in your book, you talk about watching, because people can watch then the eggs when they start to hatch and when the eaglets are born. And you also mentioned that eagles don't have a white head and tail when they're until they're about 3 to 5 years old.
Exactly.
And that might surprise people. So maybe we have seen an eagle and we didn't know it because we were looking for the characteristic white head that bald eagles
have. I was telling some of my students today, I read this book this morning to some classes, and it was really great to read it to them because there was a lot to discuss, because there's, you know, just like facts like that, and it, a lot of questions came up, and it was really fun. It was a fun book to read to the classes.
Thank you both for being here. My guests have been Terry Lou Willier and her sister Joanne Brady. They're authors of The Unstoppable Eagles. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, kcho.org. I'm Nancy Weekman. And I would also like to thank my first guest, TV weatherman Mike Graff, who has a new book on the national parks, Natural Laboratories, Scientists in the National Parks.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.